Yesterday, I said that the eco-crisis, or the reality of rather massive environmental degradation now, is the most ecumenical of issues in that it cuts across everything. And that included what we took up yesterday, namely basic questions of who we are as human beings in the scheme of things. Mm-hmm. So questions of human identity and vocation. The eco-crisis also challenges our understandings and images of God. And that's what I want to provoke with this title, Is God Green? The eco-crisis has us looking at our inherited understandings of God and asking questions to them. And it has us asking what a helpful, appropriate, faithful understanding of God is in face of the reality that is ours at this time and place. I neglected yesterday to relate to the overall theme for the summer, listen to the sacred, even though in many ways it seems a kind of obvious connection. But we talked yesterday of the common creation story and the awe that it elicits now among many people, including a lot of scientists, so that you get a very different tone from scientists these days compared in the past. And I've been struck by the fact that for so many scientists, especially ecologists, the explication of the complex pageant of life as they see it in such intricate interdependency elicits awe and mystery, so that they start talking as follows. This is from a letter by 34 internationally renowned scientists, led by Carl Sagan and Hans Bethe, a letter they wrote which is entitled Open Letter to the Religious Community. And the letter includes this paragraph. As scientists, many of us have had profound experiences of awe and reverence before the universe. We understand that what is regarded as sacred is more likely to be treated with care and respect. Our planetary home should be so treated. Efforts to safeguard and cherish the environment need to be infused with a vision of the sacred. That's not been the normal way in which scientists express themselves, and they haven't usually said, okay, you folks in the religious community, this is your issue as it is ours, and we're appealing to you to understand our planetary home in terms of the sacred and to act in ways that treat it such. So I just wanted to make that that connection to the village's summer theme of listen to the sacred, and to continue that this evening when we talk about our pictures, our understandings, our images of God as we face the eco-crisis, and we ask what new angles on understanding God we are being sent these days. To get to the discussion, I want to make two relatively brief presentations. One is a presentation of classic or basic strands in the Hebrew understanding of God, and the second is one proposed by a Christian theologian. Her name is Sally McFay, in a new book entitled The Body of God, a kind of model or understanding of God that she is proposing as our proper understanding of God now. The reason I want to take one old and one new is just because that is the kind of theological ferment that our reality confronts us with now. We look at the inherited traditions and we ask, what is it that is viable, usable, still faithful from those understandings? We look at the new reality in front of us and we ask, what is it communicating to us, or if one dare, revealing to us about the nature of divinity and the understanding of God in our own time. So I just want to take one as an explication of Hebrew understandings and ask, what is that which is still powerful for our present reality there, and then a newer understanding from Sally McFay. I put on the board up here, and I will speak these out for the sake of the tape, some of the resources that I have drawn upon. For the Hebrew understanding of God, I picked a couple of Jewish scholars, Michael Lerner. Some of you know the magazine Tikkun. He's the editor of that magazine. Is now getting some publicity because he's being called Hillary Clinton's guru. I noticed in the paper the other day. She has become quite enamored with his view of the politics of meaning, as he calls it. Anyway, Michael Lerner, an article in a chapter in a book by Michael Zweig. The book is entitled Religion and Economic Justice. His chapter is entitled Jewish Liberation Theology. He didn't write it with our reality in mind. I'm picking up some of his clues there about what he's doing, namely explication, Jewish understanding of God. And then a book which is one that I've learned an enormous amount from and I highly recommend, by a Jewish feminist scholar. Her name is Tikva Fremerkensky, and the book is entitled In the Wake of the Goddesses, Women, Culture, and the Biblical Transformation of Pagan Myth. It is a book about the movement in the ancient Near East from the religions of gods and goddesses to biblical monotheism, and the changes that take place in the thinking about humanity, nature, gender, and God in the process. So I just want to draw from that. And then I have mentioned Sally McFay and the body of God. Now, let's see, it's 5 minutes before the hour, and I want to ensure that we have discussion. So I will take, no matter where we are in this, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'm just going to stop. And then if we haven't finished the presentation, we'll use what time we have left to discuss what we have shared. I think I want to simply put out Sally McFaig's proposal for understanding the cosmos, the world, the earth as the body of God first. Not discuss it, simply give you that picture very, very briefly, and then go to the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. McFaig understands what she's doing as wholly in keeping with Christian theologians' task, because she says Christianity is par excellence the religion of incarnation, so that we strongly emphasize God as creator. We talk about the incarnation of God in Jesus Christ, and somehow or another present in, with, and under all things. We talk about resurrection of the body, and so the body is the metaphor and the model by which she wants to understand God as well as ourselves and the world. But she says, for a wide variety of reasons, which she discusses, Christianity has never played out all of the clues that it has in its own legacy for viewing the world, indeed the universe, as the body of God. And she wants to take, she says now the eco-crisis is asking us to play out all the dimensions of God understood in terms of body. God is embodied in all that is, from an atom to the entire cosmos. The world is the shape of God's appearing. What she does is revive from the tradition the organic model of all things interrelated, but she rejects the way in which that has been played out before. It was most prominent with the medieval understanding of God. Everything was organically related, but it was organically related everything was connected to everything else. Thomas knew that just as well as Paul. But it was done so on the basis of a hierarchical rendering of things instead of the organic picture presented by modern-day scientists, by ecologists, of the interconnectedness of all things in an intricate living and non-living system where the organic and the inorganic are part of a total system. Then she treats all of that theologically as on the model of the parts and the totality as the model of God. I just want to simply say that and ask a question that we'll return to later. The question is, do you find this model of body, this model of earth and the bodies of the whole cosmos as the body of God, a suggestive, helpful one? Do you find that picture of God the one you are drawn to for our kind of situation? All right. Now to go to the Hebrew understanding of God and pick up the motifs that will be familiar to you from the biblical account, and see if they continue to have some power. And I'll start with Fermor Kensky's In the Wake of the Goddesses. And she has too much to say there for a very brief time, so I'm going to scale this down to just a couple of comments. Fermor Kensky says that the picture of the gods and the goddesses in the ancient Near East was as follows with respect to nature. The powers of nature were controlled by the gods and the goddesses in these religions of Assyria, Sumeria. Many of these gods and goddesses were in contention, conflict, interaction with one another. And human beings were praying to them, trying to appease them, performing rituals, writing hymns, etc., in order to effect the proper balance of forces in this contending world of gods and goddesses, so that fertility of the soil might come round again when needed, so that the rains might have come on time, etc. They tried to collaborate with the gods and the goddesses, who really were the ones that controlled nature, so to collaborate with them as human beings, or to play them off against one another, as to assure the reliability of nature, because they were utterly and totally dependent upon the natural forces. So basically, nature then is an arena of powers and forces in interaction, and the drama out there in nature among the various forces determines the condition of the world. All right. With monotheism, which becomes slowly, not overnight, the religion of the Hebrews, they also start with a pantheon of gods. You can still read it in the Old Testament. But gradually, it becomes a monotheistic religion. And with monotheism, one God, the relations between gods and goddesses no longer controls the world, and nature, nor culture and humanity. And all of these have to be rethought now. Among other things, the one God now absorbs all of the functions of the gods and the goddesses. And it's intriguing to read the Hebrew Bible, looking for the wake, religion in the wake of the goddesses. Because the Yahweh, or it takes a while, God gets many names, but the one God has to absorb all of the functions that were previously held by gods and goddesses. And this one God, then, is the source of all of the requirements of the good life. This one God now is master of the universe. So that land, abundance, health, procreation, security, protection are all found in the one God, Yahweh. This one is also then the master of nature, Lord of creation. People no longer, she says, have to worry about the sun rising or setting. Because the sovereign creator created it to rise and set, and all is in his power. People no longer have to worry about helping the earth to be fertile, and because it was created fertile by the one creator who sustains it. The earth on its own, as created by the one God of all heaven and earth, is dependable, reliable, sustainable. But then, who is to blame when the land becomes polluted, or the famines strike, or drought occurs? Who's left? It's not a matter of some god or goddess controlling the forces of nature. If there's anything that's out of kilter, who is to blame?
Satan.
No, there's actually, there isn't talk of Satan.
Well,
it's very interesting. Yes, it's people. It's the people of Israel, actually. Later on, in some apocalyptic literature, you do have the return of that. And she has very interesting things to say about that. But the primary picture is one of the people of Israel. And by the 10th generation, Noah's generation, the barrenness of the ground is widespread, and God has to actually recreate. Read that very carefully. It's human beings that have caused the devastation of the land and have brought upon the earth its infertility. And in this monotheistic... In this monotheistic religion of God as master of the universe, then, the blame doesn't fall on gods and goddesses spatting with one another, but on Israel. Israel has not lived righteously, or else the earth would not suffer.
Was this transformation going on at the same time as the Old Testament canon was coming
to the Old Testament canon is much, much later. The Old Testament canon isn't until about four centuries after, in the Common Era.
Old Testament canon.
Right. At the time of Jesus, you don't have an Old Testament canon.
Well, but how about the Septuagint? I mean, there was certainly a collection of Hebrew writings.
There were some Psalms and there were some of the prophets, but the canon, as a collection of materials agreed upon, is made by the rabbis. They had nothing in what is now...
But the Old Testament period was a lot of stuff more or less agreed upon, wasn't it? And more or less like the present-day Old Testament?
Oh, that's not till much, much later.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
I mean, there is no Hebrew Bible as canon until after Rabbinic Judaism, which is a first century phenomena.
Was the Septuagint then just kind of a literary convenience?
No, the Septuagint is, what's the date of the Septuagint?
Wasn't that B.C.?
No.
Alexandria?
I don't think so.
Oh, I'm all screwed.
You have the Psalms, which are widely used.
But the prophets too.
Yeah, and some of the prophetic writings.
Yeah.
But he was asked about the canon.
Yeah. Well, what about the creation story?
The creation stories
that's
out of the monarchy. It's when Israel is a state that the creation story. Now, lots of this stuff is oral tradition, but that's a different question from the canon. Canon is a decision about these books belong. But what I'm talking about is way back at the beginnings of Israel itself.
Okay, that's maybe more important. Somewhere that
the transition from gods and goddesses to monotheistic.
Say maybe in the second millennium BC or something? Before the time of David?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Which is I mean, it's recalling, it's the time that's recalled when they recall the Exodus, and then the stories of the patriarchs before that. Yeah. So this is all present in old materials of the first, the Book of the Covenant, which is among the oldest materials. That's what I'm referring to here in this relationship of a growing understanding of the one God, and then the place of the people, and having to think nature, culture, gender is rethought, etc. That's all before anything like the canon comes into play.
Yeah, okay. It's a red herring to talk.
It's a Shema Israel. I mean, the basic creed of Israel, the notion of the covenant, etc., is all old material. There isn't any Bible at this time. There are rich oral traditions, and there are some written traditions, but it's not a Bible. In any case, the picture is that while Israel can't quite figure out the line of causation between injustice in society and unfaithfulness to God on the one hand, and the failures of nature on the other hand, they are convinced that it must be connected to the fact that they have betrayed the covenant in some way or other. So that Israel or other humans, sometimes it's human beings, are to blame. And so Frumkensky points out that what we have here then is this conviction that human beings, and particularly Israel, is responsible for the land's well-being. And they have to assure that by living a righteous life in society and a faithful life before God. I'll come to Michael Lerner in just a minute. I found it quite interesting in her comments that she says, while Israel was wrong in its understanding of a strict causation, line of causation between human deeds on the one hand and Earth's woes on the other, they never figured out, they were sure there was a one-to-one relationship, they just couldn't figure out exactly why that happened that way. Partly it was because they had bad signs instead of good signs. And while it was Israel was wrong in its picture of nature as having no vulnerabilities that were not related to human beings, that is, that they had a picture of nature as one of a kind of pristine, harmonious, cyclical view of nature, where if you just left it alone, it repeated its cycles in a harmonious way. So nature was in and of itself reliable and would meet all the needs of its own well-being. God had created it thus. She says that's also incorrect. We know that isn't the case with nature. But she says, despite these facts, she says, now the picture of biblical monotheism is, rather ironically, utterly correct. That is, the burden of the world now, and including the well-being of nature, is so utterly and largely in human hands, and we are so, such an impact on the natural environment, that now their reading is right. And furthermore, she says, it's a kind of ripe time for biblical monotheism, because we stand utterly responsible before the one God and the God of the cosmos, and there are no other powers to hide behind, including God's power. In a world where that we know is created and functions as a totality. So she says these ancient pictures were, in their own times, quite incorrect, and now they are strangely and ironically relevant to a degree never imagined. The Jews were always, the Hebrews were always sure that human beings were utterly responsible. They also, she said, always tried to run and hide behind other powers. And there is even an effort to kind of recreate some of the gods and the goddesses because they don't want to have that much responsibility for the whole earth and to have to carry that burden. And then she goes on to say, we too are always trying to find other powers to hide behind, but now we don't even have God's powers to hide behind because the shift of power has occurred. So she says, the Bible's presentation is not perfect at all, but on this account of the relationship of humanity to nature's well-being is also linked to humanity's justice in society, which is a Hebrew kind of link to make. All before God who creates the awesome unity of all things. And then the Hebrew Bible is strangely contemporary and maybe still ahead of us. And on that last point too, I want us to discuss in about 5 minutes, but on that last point too, she's right. We have been trying to see the connections between the way in which human beings treat one another and the way in which the earth is treated. And we now know that there's an intimate linkage between the justice in the society and how people treat one another and how they treat the natural world around them. On that point too, she said, they were correct because they were so sure that injustice in society was somehow directly related to the fact that the earth was not well, and so the crops failed because Israel did not treat the poor properly. That's becoming more and more literally the case with us. So I find this a rather interesting turnaround where this ancient text is strangely correct in ways in which it wasn't when it was asserted. And to read now the covenant with Noah everyone remembers the covenant with Abraham, nobody remembers the covenant with all the creatures of the earth. To read that now is a moving thing. Okay, finally, some comments from Michael Lerner. And I'm still asking the same question. Are there motifs from these ancient convictions about God which answer the question, is God green? That is to say, what is the understanding and image of God particularly faithful and appropriate for our time and place in view of the eco-crisis? I'll just choose a couple of things from Michael Lerner. The distinctive theme of Jewish faith was not the one that's common in ecology and in environmental circles today, and in theologies of the environment. That picture of God or the divine is of a power or force in the universe that transcends human powers but suffuses all of nature with its energy. So God is to be sensed in the energy which pulses through all things living.
He's saying that's not the Jewish picture.
That's something which he thinks is fine. It's called creation spirituality and creation theology. It's not the distinctive Jewish picture. The rather and injustice and commands and makes possible the transformation of the world on the terms of community. That's the Hebrew picture of this divine power, rejects oppression and injustice, and makes possible the transformation of the world on the terms of community. And Charlene Spretnak, in her wonderful book, In the States of Grace, she goes through the world's religions, and she says, the three religions of the book, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, have one thing in common, which distinguishes them from a number of other religions, focus on community and social justice. And it comes from the picture of God as the liberator of the slaves of Egypt and forming a people. The experience of the divine power for the Hebrews is the power of peoplehood. That's what it is. And this Hebrew conviction about this God and this God's power led to the strong ethical sense and the community sense that we are all morally responsible before God for the condition of the world. It comes through all the time. This is not gods and goddesses playing with the powers of the world. Human beings are morally responsible before God for the condition of the world. In the ancient world, that was an extraordinary affirmation of human agency and freedom. It said, against most other religions, it said, life is not fated. It is in your hands to be co-participants with God. The talk nowadays in theology is often to talk about co-participation or co-creation with God. That language is from the rabbis of the first century. And they're simply carrying on the Hebrew picture that human beings are co-participants with God in the transformation of the world on the terms of community and social justice. And there aren't many things that could stand in much sharper contrast to pictures of the world that life is essentially fated or in the hands of gods and goddesses. Now, the foundations of this, and the fact that this is also a reliable power, this power for transformation toward a moral order in which human beings play the important role, are, of course, in the people's own transformation. It was the God who knew the sufferings of slaves and heard their cries, the God of divine pathos, the God whose power was experienced as the power for peoplehood and the power for freedom. This God creates a people from a ragtag band who were no people. This God hews a way where there was no way. This God, in the pantheon of gods, was the only one who, in the words of Hannah and later Mary, pulled down princes from their thrones and exalted the lowly and fed the hungry and sent the rich empty away. None of the other gods did that. So that's the picture. This God also gave this saved people the vocation then of shaping a society and a community that was to live righteously in the way that, in a manner like this God had treated them. So Lerner says, Judaism was not just a religion about how wonderful the physical world is, but a religion that insisted there is nothing inevitable about the hierarchies of the social world. That's where you get such an emphasis on transformation in the direction of justice as a community vocation and a community life. Now I'll finish by saying the second thing he says. At the same time, Judaism was a religion about how wonderful the physical world is. The liberating God was first liberator, but then they thought to themselves, like, gosh, this God is the creator of the whole cosmos. It's God the liberator who is also God the creator. That's the astounding discovery that dawns upon them. Thus, the Hebrew Bible over and over again celebrates the immense grandeur of the creation, gives thanks for the breath of life that animates all of creation. It's nothing less than the same spirit that brooded over the waters at the dawn of creation and that gives the breath of life to each and every creature. This religion marvels at the detail of God's good creation. Furthermore, there's a universal moral order in creation itself, put there by this creator. So one can learn from the ants and the badgers and the foxes, as it says, both in Job and Proverbs and elsewhere. And it's because these two are Adama. They are the same stuff as Adam. They're all of the ground, and we'll return there. So, let me finish by just reading a part of Psalm 77, and I want you to listen to what is a kind of double helix genetic ribbon of Hebrew faith, namely two strands. The power that created the universe and sustains it day to day is the same power that champions the powerless and creates the demand for a moral universe infused with justice and compassion and lays on people the responsibility of a moral responsibility to so shape the world. Listen for both God the liberator and God the creator tied together in ways which never get untangled. They never get separated, rarely ever. Remembering Yahweh's achievements, this is after the psalmist is in some despondency. This particular psalmist, I'm not going to read you those verses, is racked by the world's troubles and fearful that God has forgotten to be gracious and compassionate. So the psalmist makes every effort then to remember the character of the God of Israel and reaches deep to confess the following in awe and fear and gratitude. Remembering Yahweh's achievements, remembering your marvels in the past, I reflect on all that you did. I ponder all your achievements. God, your ways are holy. What God, small g, is so great as God, capital G? You are the God who did marvelous things. Now listen to what they are. And forced nations to acknowledge your power, with your own arm redeeming your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. When the waters saw it was you, we went right from nation and people to waters. When the waters saw it was you, God, when the waters saw it was you, they recoiled, shuddering to their depths. The clouds poured down water, the sky thundered, your arrows darted out, your thunder crashed as it rolled, your lightning lit up the world, the earth shuddered and quaked. You strode across the sea, you marched across the ocean, but your steps could not be seen. Then what? You guided your people like a flock by the hands of Moses and Aaron. I mean, we just go from one episode in the life of, in history, to an episode in nature, never distinguishing history from nature. Okay, so Lerner sums it all up by saying that for the Hebrews, celebration of the grandeur of creation goes hand in hand with transformation of the social world. He goes on to cite the Sabbath as a lovely summary symbol of this. Sabbath is both a day to give thanks for life and the blessing of creation, and a day to remember liberation from slavery and our vocation of witness to God as creator and redeemer. The climax of Sabbath and creation is not the arrival. Climax of the creation story, incidentally, is not the arrival of human beings. It doesn't stop there. The climax of the creation story is the Sabbath, which is a celebration of all of creation and a time for rest for all of creation, harmony, enjoyment of all of it before God. And then he then is, in essence, makes much the same point as Kremer Kensky, that that God's saving presence in nature and society is part of a common redemptive action, that human beings are responsible both for the shape of the social world of which they are a part and for the condition of the natural world, which is intimately tied up to it. You just don't separate these things. One is woven with the other. So that's as much as I'm going to say. I want to repeat the question. I'm not going to go back to Sally McFaig and the picture of the body of God. Just to repeat this question, if we think about now images, understandings, pictures of God, as we look about a world where the planet's life support systems are in serious jeopardy, what kind of picture of God is both helpful and faithful for that? And are there things yet to be retained from some, if not all, of the biblical motif? Are there pictures of God which need to come out of our own creative response? Since if you do things biblically, you understand that the life of the people of God goes on and on and on. It doesn't stop with the closing of the canon. Yeah, Linda?
Well, this has come up in other contexts before, but it seems to me that the problematic part of any pictures is the one which is, if God is creator, sustainer, whatever, that we can mess it up and there's somebody there to fix it,
mm-hmm.
as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the image of the Michael Werner images that you were bringing up,
mm-hmm.
as a counter to that. But I think that there's somehow partly in this picture of having this God that is creator, sustainer, is that somehow we can pretty much do what we want and somehow there's Deus ex something, or maybe not ex machina, but Deus ex something that can come in and keep it all going.
Yeah. And that, however, is a picture, a Christian notion of God, which develops more out of Greek understandings of a perfection of God. And then in all qualities, omniscient, omnipotent, that picture of God is not one which is fully in keeping with either with the Hebrew Bible. Although there is a forever an ambivalence in the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, between the sovereign God who is master of the universe and has all powers contained within the God, and the vulnerable God who is susceptible to all manner of influence by human beings. And this God requires human co-participation in order that the moral order come about. Can never quite make up their mind about that. But what you're talking about is a legacy which is exacerbated greatly among the Christians. Let me just read to you, this is from Sally McFaig, let me just read to you the First Vatican Council picture of God. And then you know where that's coming from, the one where we have the Deus ex machina, we do what we wish, God will somehow rescue us. First Vatican Council. The Holy Catholic Apostolic Roman Church believes and confesses that there is one true and living God, creator and Lord of heaven and earth, almighty, eternal, immense, incomprehensible, infinite in intelligence, in will, and in all perfection, who, as being one soul, absolutely simple and immutable spiritual substance, is to be declared really and essentially distinct from the world, of supreme beatitude in and of himself, and ineffably exalted above all things beside himself which exist or are conceivable. How anyone has a relationship with that God, I don't know. Much less the world. But that picture of a transcendent, self-contained, powerful God on the one hand, and then the world down here. Yeah, totally. Totally so. And that separate transcendent God doesn't square up with either Sally McFaig, God as embodied in the cosmos, or the Hebrew notion, which certainly does have that picture of kind of creator and redeemer of all things, but much more entangled and reliant upon human beings, yeah. Does anybody like McFaig's proposal about the body of God? Understanding earth as the body of God, or all matter as the body of God? Isn't that a problem for folks, or isn't that suggestive?
It doesn't feel big enough for me.
I see. Even if it's the cosmos? How big do you want
it? Well, as much as I can conceive of the cosmos, it isn't big enough.
Uh-huh.
And so, if it's more than that, then it's beyond me anyway. So maybe that isn't. I don't know, but just Earth, or just like our solar system.
Yeah, well, she means the cause. She means all matter. And I hasten to add that she doesn't say this is all God is. I mean, she calls it. It's pan. This is a kind of technical term of pan. Theism, the thee, God, and in pan, all things. And it doesn't say that when you've got the cosmos, you've got God. It means that God is in, with, and under, and embodied in all things, all matter. So in some sense, God is bigger than the cosmos, but not in any way that we would or could know about. Just your brow is furrowed. Yeah. I mean, if she's right, it has tremendous implications when one needs to work on it.
Well, my feeling is that she is right, and that part of that cosmos, universe, and creation in the relation to God is human beings. That, that we are in this mess with everything else, and that there's no separation of it. That the cause and effect is in this intricate existence of God as the universe and the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
I remember what just flashed to me was, I don't know where it was, but that it's so delicate that even a butterfly fluttering its wings in China has an impact.
Yes.
On the weather.
On the weather, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So and we are part of that. I mean, it's not like, you know, we're something independent of a butterfly.
Yeah.
We're God's creation, even though we're having a heck of a lot more impact than a butterfly.
Yeah.
But we're in it and with it.
Yeah. Yeah. In that sense, in the way in which you described it, it's even a more comprehensive and intimate sense than the Hebrews, who really were, and both Lerner and Firmakensky say that one of the drawbacks of the Hebrew Bible is that it really is focused on the relationship between God and human beings, and particularly Israel in particular. Now that doesn't render nature as the rest of nature simply as a stage for history. No, they're not modern. That's a modern distinction. They know much more about it. I mean, after all, the Sabbath is also for the animals, so they know about the intimacy. But the God relationship is really focused on that axis, whereas as you describe it and as McFaig describes it, the relationship with God is to be found in all things. And human beings are, and nature is a comprehensive term, and we're a particular expression of it. And therefore, the if there is redemption, that isn't simply the redemption of humanity, but it must of necessity be the redemption of all things or nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that kind of relationship. Yeah.
In a very intimate, not just cause and effect, but very intimate and interrelated, totally non-separable.
Yeah.
Can't pull man apart from it.
Yeah. I find it very appealing.
Is the Gaia hypothesis relevant here?
The guy, I think the thing is also helpful. First of all, the Gaia hypothesis from James Lovelock is exactly that. It's a hypothesis. It's not a proven theory. The hypothesis is that the Earth is a living, self-correcting organism as a totality. And McFaig, in talking about the common creation story, by which she means everything was started at a particular point in time, we are all kin to one another, we're all stardust, that wood is also stardust, that metal there is also stardust, and so we're radically kin to one another, radically differentiated. She's taking her cues from that rather than from the Gaia hypothesis. And she says it's a mistake to tie one's theological reflection too closely to any one specific scientific theory, but you need to take the broad lineaments of the picture of reality that you can know, that your best lights can tell you at any given time in order for your theology to be credible. Mm-hmm. So she's not going to depend on the Gaia hypothesis, but maybe that isn't what you meant by asking whether it was relevant here.
Well, I was just, first of all, trying to figure out the extent to which there's some awareness of that, the Gaia hypothesis here, and obviously there is. It bothers me because of its purportedly scientific character. It seems to me to be one of these untestable, intrinsically untestable
things. No, I don't think so. I mean, the elements of the Gaia hypothesis are being tested now. That's what they're trying, that's why it's a hypothesis. But it has not been shown to...
Okay, but put it the other way, to come at it from avoiding the scientific thing, I feel a little bit easier about it. So that maybe what McFaig has to say is I would be more receptive to.
She talks about the Gaia hypothesis, but not in a way that makes it a primary source. She thinks there is much to be said for, again, an organic understanding of the nature of nature and ourselves as a part of that, rather than a mechanistic model or a model that just runs between human beings and God as the religious model, etc. So she likes that notion that is there, but she's not. This isn't theology of the Gaia hypothesis.
The question that you're struggling with, doesn't it? I've been trying to get my mind around what your the various perspectives that you're describing. It seems to me that the bottom line kind of is how do we put together some kind of a theological basis that holds us both responsible for our role in creation, keeps us tied to our historical understanding of who God is, and creates an arena in which we can experience the grace of God that we know in Jesus Christ. And in the middle of that, we are able to interact in a responsible, faithful, religious way with the created order. It seems to me that's kind of the question behind
that. That is the question.
It's really important that we're able to do that, that we're able to see ourselves as responsible for managing creation. That's the parts of it, at least. We can certainly destroy it if we have the power to destroy it. We also have the power to manage it and not destroy it within certain ranges. And how we connect those kinds of concerns that are current in our culture with our faith and with our practice of it and with our articulation of what it is to be a believer today.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure whether these things are helpful or not. I mean, is the task to put together some kind of a general network of theology that we can acknowledge, let's say in the Lutheran Church even, and say this is kind of where we are, and it's a it's the strongest platform for us to begin to do things. The statement on the care of creation that's coming to the Assembly mm-hmm. in the summer is, I think, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, this is much more theoretical than that, but I always kind of move toward the pragmatic.
Yeah.
And say, you know, where does this leave us?
Yeah.
Does this equip us better to be more responsible agents of Christ in the created order? That's not even a question, it's just kind of a ramble that I did there, I guess.
The most practical questions now are the ones which are questions about the most basic images, beliefs that one has. We're in quite an extraordinary time. All times of major change and discontinuity do a flip on us. When times are settled, you can assume some pretty foundational questions have been settled. People's understanding of themselves, their picture of God. And then it's kind of playing that out and it's kind of fine-tuning. When things are very unsettled, the most practical questions are the questions which give direction as to which way you should go and who you are and what you're about. And so people like Lerner, McVeigh, and so on, think that by asking the God question or the question of our understanding of ourselves, etc., their reason for doing so is a highly practical reason. We've gotten ourselves into some serious trouble. Part of that trouble is who we thought we were and what we believed, the models by which we treated nature. So this effort is regarded by them as a highly, highly, highly practical one that requires that we look at our most basic conceptions all over again. We may well reappropriate elements. We may decide to scuttle some elements too. And we may, by the grace of God, understand some things in a new way that we haven't before. And I think that she would, Sally McVeigh now would respond to your question by underlining that kind of practical character of it, but also by underlining the fact that it's not simply a way of reasserting or coming to a fuller consciousness of, say, our human powers and responsibilities. That might be part of it. But she is also insisting that we need to understand better the way in which our world works. We can be very morally sensitive about our responsibilities, but if we don't understand the way in which our powers are playing out, because we don't understand how ecosystems work, then all of that is good intentions and horrendous outcomes. So that there's an element of knowledge about how the world works that is a call also for, and then the theological images of God and of ourselves and our picture of who Jesus Christ is for us today somehow have to also come to terms with that knowledge. So it isn't simply being sensitive in a way we haven't been sensitive to a good Hebrew notion. It's understanding better. So, yeah, and we might decide that we can't do lots of things because we can't know in this intricate, interconnected way what the line of consequences is, how it's going to play out.